So hello, everyone. We're going to go ahead and get started. My name is Merlene Santil, and I lead operations for the product and technology organization in the CTO office at Intuit. I am also a Watermark board member and really thrilled to be your MC for today's session. I will introduce you to our thought leader and also help coordinate with Q&A in the last 10 to 15 minutes of the session. Microphones will be available in the aisle so you can line up to ask questions. So I'm thrilled to be here to support the advancement of our women leaders with a conference that offers a blend of practical tools, advice, inspiration, and peer networking. We are committed to your empowerment, to inspire you, to make your mark in your community, your careers, and your communities. We have an amazing hour in store for you on the topic of creating your meaningful life. It is my pleasure to introduce you to Emily Esfahani Smith, who is the author of The Power of Meaning, Creating a Life That Matters. She writes about culture, relationships, and psychology. Her work has appeared in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Atlantic, and elsewhere. She is also a columnist for the New Criterion and an editor at Stanford University's Hoover Institution, where she manages the Ben Franklin Circles Project, an initiative to build community and purpose across the country. Please put your hands together for Emily Esfahani Smith.
Thanks, Merlene. I appreciate it. Hello, everyone. It's great to be with you today. I am so thrilled to see you all here, and I'm also grateful that you're here because I know that I'm standing in between you and the cocktail hour. So thank you especially for waiting one more hour before all the fun begins to be with me. So as Merlene mentioned, I'm a journalist and a writer, and I write about well-being and positive psychology, the field of scientific study of the good life. And in particular, over the last few years, I have been researching and writing about meaning and how we can lead meaningful lives. And that's the topic of the book that I recently wrote. So I'm here to share with you some of what I learned in that process, but I'm also here to learn from you and to hear from you. So please, at the end of this talk, ask me questions, give me feedback, tell me your own stories of finding meaning in life or of struggling to find meaning in life. There's two microphones up here in both of the aisles, so just feel free to come forward at the end of the talk and we'll get a conversation going. So I'd like to begin by telling you the story of one of the women I interviewed several years ago for my book. Her name is Ashley Richmond. Ashley doesn't lead a very glamorous life. She doesn't shop at Whole Foods, she doesn't go to fancy restaurants, and she didn't grow up in a big city. What she does do is spend the majority of her time shoveling animal poop from one place to another. Her hours are terrible, and so is her pay, and she leaves work most days feeling physically exhausted because her work is so grueling. And yet Ashley told me that this is her dream job. Ashley is a zookeeper at the Detroit Zoo, where she cares for wallabies, kangaroos, and giraffes. She doesn't feel good or happy all the time when she's working. About 80% of her time, she told me, is spent cleaning animal waste. And that can be physically grueling work, especially when you're dealing with large animals like giraffes. But she derives an enormous amount of meaning from what she does. And in fact, she considers her job a calling. When I interviewed her several years ago and asked her, "What makes your life meaningful?" she told me that her purpose isn't cleaning up animal poop. It's taking care of the animals and doing everything in her power to make their lives as good and as rich and as stimulating as possible. None of them, she pointed out, chose to be there, and yet she, as their zookeeper, has a duty and a responsibility to take care of them and make their lives as good as possible. My book was inspired by people like Ashley, people whose stories I thought were being left out of the cultural conversation on well-being in our country. We're constantly getting the message that a good life is a happy life, and that you have to pursue happiness to feel fulfilled, and that if you do, and if you find happiness, you'll be more attractive and more successful and wealthier and better liked. It's hard to go to a bookstore or even navigate to your favorite website without finding an article or book about the 10 steps to a happier life. Happiness, we're led to believe, is the whole point and purpose of existence. And yet, when I was reflecting on that message several years ago, it occurred to me that there were many people in my life who I admired, and many men and women throughout history who I admired, who weren't focused on chasing happiness. Some of them were wrestling with difficult emotions like sadness and grief and stress. Others of them had led tragic lives that they were trying to make sense of, while others were devoted to difficult goals and purposes, to pursuits and causes that were trying to make the world better in some way. These people did not feel happy all the time. And yet the way I saw it, their lives were extremely meaningful. The people I'm thinking of were parents and nurses and teachers and entrepreneurs. They were the great men and women of history, from Martin Luther King Jr. to Mother Teresa to the Holocaust survivor Viktor Frankl. All of them were devoted to trying to move the needle forward in some way, to trying to improve the lives of those around them, whether it was just their people in their immediate circle, like their family members and friends, or entire communities and nations of people. And in fact, part of the reason why their lives were so rich is because they weren't focused on their own personal happiness. They were focused on something bigger, on improving the world in some way. Think about Ashley. Her life was about taking care of the animals and making their lives better. Or to take a more historical example, think about Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the German pastor during World War II who stood up to the Nazis and helped Jews flee Germany and was ultimately executed for the Nazis for what he did. He was not a person who was choosing to lead a happy life. He was choosing to lead a meaningful life. And yet these kinds of examples were being left out of the cultural conversation on well-being, even though there is a real dignity to this kind of life, and that this kind of life is good and meaningful, regardless of how happy somebody might feel at the end of the day. So I know that it sounds like I'm being critical of happiness, and I want to make clear that I am a happy person, and that there are people in my life, I want them to be happy, and that you can certainly lead a meaningful life and be happy at the same time. But the question, I think, is which of these two things do you set as your goal and pursue? Do you set meaning as your goal and pursue that, or do you set happiness as your goal and pursue that? And I want to convince you that you should set meaning as your goal. And there's two reasons for it. One, a new body of social science research has found that when we pursue happiness and chase it and value it the way that our culture encourages us to do, we actually end up feeling unhappier as a result and even more lonely. Whereas when we set meaning as our goal and pursue meaningful endeavors, we actually experience a more deep and complicated and enduring form of well-being down the road. So let me tell you about a study that will help clarify this point. So several years ago, a couple of researchers invited several hundred people into their lab, and they divided them into two groups. They told one group to go out and pursue meaning for 10 days by doing at least one thing each day to make their lives more meaningful. And they told the other group to go out and pursue happiness for 10 days by doing at least one thing each day to make their lives happier. So the people in the happiness condition did things like sleeping in and playing games and eating sweets and going shopping, while the people in the meaning condition did things like cheering a friend up or reflecting on their values or working on a project or studying. After the study's completion, the researchers checked in on the well-being of the participants. 10 days after the end of the 10 days, the people in the happiness condition predictably felt happier. But 3 months later, there was no difference in their well-being as before the experiment. So that happiness had completely evaporated. It was as if they had not done the experiment at all. In the meaning condition, it was different. After 10 days, the people did not feel happier, but they did rate their lives as more meaningful, which makes sense because the meaningful endeavors that they were pursuing were sometimes effortful and hard and stressful, so they weren't happiness-inducing. But the real interesting thing was that 3 months later, there was a very measurable difference in their well-being. The people who had pursued meaning said that they felt more enriched, inspired, and part of something greater than myself. They also reported fewer negative moods. So this research and other studies like it show that the pursuit of meaning ultimately leaves us with a deeper sense of well-being down the road. It also helps us feel more satisfied, and as people close in on the end of their lives and are approaching death, it actually makes them feel more at peace and have fewer regrets. I think the constant emphasis on happiness has distracted us from what really matters. Human beings have a need for meaning. We're creatures that seek meaning and make meaning and yearn for meaning. If you think about when we look up at the stars at night, we don't see random dots in the sky or random balls of fire. We see constellations and shapes. We see swans, warriors, and bears. We tell stories about what we see. We craft myths about them. We reflect on our lives and on our place in the universe and on how we can make our lives count. And it's the same with all of the great literature and philosophy and art that our civilization has produced. It's all in the service of this quest for meaning. The first great work, for example, of literature, the Epic of Gilgamesh, is all about how you can lead a meaningful life knowing that you will die. And in the century since, the urgency of that quest has not faded. We all want to know that our lives amount to more than the sum of our experiences, that they matter and that they count. We each need a compelling reason to wake up in the morning, a why that helps us get through both the good and the bad of life. And no two people I found will necessarily have the same why. So over the last few years, I've interviewed dozens of people about what makes their lives meaningful. People like Ashley about what their why is. I spoke to a drug dealer turned entrepreneur. I spoke to a woman dying of terminal cancer. I spoke to a former astronaut. I also talked to sociologists, neuroscientists, and psychologists, and I turned to the great works of the past and the great thinkers of the past, from the Buddha to George Eliot, the novelist, to Viktor Frankl. Along the way, I met lots of different kinds of people, and I heard many different stories, people from all kinds of stations of life. And no two of them told me the exact same thing about what makes their lives meaningful. And yet, as I put the research together, there were four themes that came up again and again in the stories that I heard and in the research that I did. When people tell you about what makes their lives meaningful, they talk about having rich relationships and strong bonds to others. They talk about having something worthwhile to do with their time. They talk about crafting narratives that explain who they are and their place in the world. And finally, they talk about experiences of self-loss and encounters with beauty where they feel small and yet connected to the world around them. These are what I call the four pillars of meaning: belonging, purpose, storytelling, and transcendence. So I'll walk you through each of them and give you a couple of examples of them to hopefully highlight what I'm talking about here. So a sense of belonging is about being in a relationship, but not just any kind of relationship. It's about being in a relationship where you feel like you matter and are valued, and you treat the other person like he or she matters and is valued. And it's important to understand with belonging that it can exist in moments, and that you can choose to invite people to belong or choose to reject them, and that that choice has very important consequences for how meaningful you think that your life is and how meaningful another person experiences their life to be. So let me tell you a story. My friend Jonathan has a morning routine. He lives in New York City, and every day on his way to work, he stops at a newspaper vendor and buys a newspaper from the same vendor each day. Over the years, he and the vendor have developed a bit of a relationship with each other. They always ask each other about their days and how their families are, and they share a brief but meaningful bond. In a city like New York or San Jose or name the place, life can feel impersonal, especially when you're doing something like buying a newspaper. It can be so transactional, just exchanging money for goods. But Jonathan and the vendor take a second to slow down and to acknowledge each other as people, to have a human interaction. And both of them leave feeling elevated as a result. One day, though, Jonathan went to buy a paper from the vendor, and he realized that he only had big bills, and the vendor couldn't make change for him. So the vendor said, don't worry about it, you can pay me later, or just don't worry, the paper is on me this time. But Jonathan insisted on paying for the paper, so he went to a local store and bought something he didn't need so he could make change. And he came back to the vendor and he said, "Here you go, just so I don't forget." In that moment, Jonathan said, the dynamic of their relationship changed. The vendor kind of drew back and was visibly hurt by what Jonathan did. And the reason was because the vendor had made an attempt to offer kindness, to increase the level of trust and intimacy in their relationship. But Jonathan had rejected that bid for affection. And as a result of that rejection, both of them left that interaction feeling a little bit lesser because of it. Now, the vendor isn't the only one who's been cut down by rejection, and Jonathan isn't the only one who's accidentally rejected somebody. I think we've all been in that position before. And research in psychology tells us that when you experience these small moments of rejection, that you actually rate your life as less meaningful, and you also rate life in general as less meaningful. On the other hand, when you're invited to belong and shown that you're valued, you rate your life as more meaningful. And I think it makes sense. When other people treat you like you matter, and when they affirm you, you believe that your life matters as well. So the good news is that Jonathan and the vendor were able to restore their relationship. The next day, Jonathan came and he brought the vendor a cup of tea, and they continued to share a nice interaction each day. So I think the lesson is that even though belonging exists in moments and can be torn down in moments, it can also be built back up, and that it's a really powerful source of meaning in these small ways. Purpose is the second pillar of meaning. And I think that purpose for many of us sounds big, like my purpose is curing cancer or my purpose is eradicating poverty. But purpose comes in all shapes and sizes. So purpose is defined as a top-level goal, an organizing goal of your life that somehow involves a contribution to the world. So one person's purpose can indeed be to eradicate poverty or cure some disease. But another person's purpose could be much more local, like being a good colleague at work, being a good parent, being a good friend. Ashley is a wonderful example of purpose. So she has a calling to care for animals, and that's what she's here to do, she believes. She's here to contribute to the world in that way. The third pillar is storytelling. And this pillar, my book came out just a couple of weeks ago, but this pillar in that time has seemed to have been the pillar that resonates with most people for whatever reason, and maybe we can talk about that more during the Q&A. But storytelling is the act of taking our disparate experiences and weaving them into a coherent narrative that explains who we are and where we came from. It's how we make sense of our experiences and how we understand both ourselves and other people. So if you think about it, when we want people to know who we are, we share our story or parts of it with them. And when we want people to understand us, we ask them to share part of their story with us. So Carlos Eyre is somebody who I interviewed who has spent a lot of time trying to build this pillar of meaning in his life. Carlos grew up in Havana and was a child when the Cuban Revolution happened. And the revolution, he told me, is the place in his narrative where the story broke in two. So there was before the revolution and there was after the revolution. Before the revolution, he was leading a privileged life as a young boy in Havana. After the revolution, he was forced to flee to America without his parents. So he was living as an orphan, and he was leading a very difficult life. He had to lie about his age to work as a dishwasher at a hotel so he could support himself. He never saw his father again because his father remained in Cuba. And when his mother came, she didn't speak any English and had a disability, so he had to support her. Carlos experienced a lot of hardships, discrimination, poverty, after he came to America. And he spent a lot of time trying to understand how the revolution shaped him and into the person that he is today. Ultimately, he found that even though the revolution made his life much more difficult, it also helped him grow. He became a more compassionate person, his spiritual life deepened, and he was able to discover his life purpose as a result of the struggle that he underwent adjusting to life here. So reflecting on that story and making sense of it took years for him, but it ultimately brought him a sense of peace and resolution about a difficult chapter of his life. Finally, transcendence, the fourth pillar of meaning. These are moments of awe where you feel small compared to the world around you and yet also feel connected to everything. So you're lifted up beyond waking consciousness and feel this wonderful connection. In my book, I tell the story of Corey, who experienced this meditating at a Buddhist monastery. He talked about how he was sitting on a bridge overlooking a pond and how all of a sudden during his meditation, his sense of self completely dissolved. It was like a veil, he said, that evaporated. And what was left was this feeling of connectedness and unity with the world around him. And a spring of compassion welled up within him, he said. Now, this is a very dramatic example of transcendence, and not all moments of transcendence will be like that. And certainly, you don't have to experience them within a religious or spiritual setting. People can experience these moments in nature or by viewing art, listening to music. But the hallmark of the transcendent experience is that it makes you feel smaller and that it leaves you with this sense of knowledge and clarity about the world that you didn't have before. People who have had transcendent experiences, and about two-thirds of the population has, rate them as among the most meaningful experiences of their lives. So those are the four pillars of meaning: belonging, purpose, storytelling, and transcendence. When you talk to people about what makes their lives meaningful, chances are they're going to tell you a story that involves one of those pillars. But I want you to know that you don't have to have all four pillars in your life to lead a meaningful life. Some people are going to lean on some pillars more than others to find meaning. And I created a little quiz on my website to help you figure out what your pillar of meaning is if you don't know already. For me, it happens to be belonging and transcendence. And so knowing that helps me realize that, okay, this is where I find meaning from, and I can build these pillars in my life even further in order to lead a more meaningful life. So I was just talking about transcendence, and that's a concept that we tend to associate with religion. And I get the question a lot of whether you have to be religious or spiritual in order to lead a meaningful life. And I don't think that you necessarily do. You can certainly find meaning in life without believing in God, without having any kind of metaphysical basis for how you understand the world. But it's important to understand that religion has, for thousands of years, been the primary way that people have made sense of their lives. And the reason, I would argue, is because of the four pillars. So religion situates people within a community. It gives them a purpose to work towards, like being a good person. It tells them stories about why they are the way they are and why the world is the way it is. And it offers them moments of transcendence through its rituals and ceremonies and art. But what I love about the pillars is that they cut through every aspect of existence, and you can experience them whether or not you are religious. So you can find belonging by holding your child's hand or just having a meaningful conversation with the person who's checking you out of the hotel or who's selling you your coffee. You can find purpose by doing acts of kindness at work or committing yourself to contributing in your community in some way. You can build the pillar of storytelling by reflecting on your life and the key moments of it and how they shaped you. You can find transcendence by going out at night and looking up at the stars and realizing how beautiful the world is and how mysterious it is at the same time. The pillars are all around us, and meaning is all around us. I think that there's this myth in our culture that to lead a meaningful life is some grand or esoteric pursuit that you have to travel to a monastery or go to India to find yourself in order to discover what the meaning of your life is. And that's not true. We can all find meaning in our lives by leaning on these four pillars and by connecting and contributing to something that's bigger than we are alone. If we find happiness as a result, then that's wonderful. But if we don't, then we can all still take comfort in knowing that our lives count and are making the world better in some way, just like Ashley's. Thank you. So, yeah, I think ready for questions. I think Merlene is going to moderate that.
You can just light up for questions. Come on, I know one of you.
Hi,
think we have Brave Soul coming. Great.
Hi, my name is Jennifer Carroll, and I will be turning 55 on Sunday.
Happy birthday.
Scary. And I actually am really pissed because I feel like I have more vitality, interest, meaning than I've ever had. And I'm wondering if you found, I know we talk about women are more satisfied as they get older, but if you found that, is it only something in America? Is it something that it just happens as a function of age? What is it, and how have you seen it work with those four pillars?
So it's interesting that you say that, because it's actually the case, the research shows anyways, that as people age, their sense of purpose declines, because so many of the roles that they had in life that gave them meaning, like being a little league coach, being a parent, being a supervisor, start to fade away as they come into retirement. So I think that's really interesting. And I mean, why do you say that you're pissed? I think it's great that you are more satisfied than ever.
I want to be younger now with this sense of power. But then, is there anything we can do? Because I think of my mother in the sense of meaning. Have you seen anything or any ideas of what to do for our seniors who are more isolated and don't have purpose?
Yeah. So I write about a study in my book that is of seniors and takes place in a nursing home. And so what the researchers did in this study is they gave some nursing home patients a plant to take care of and to, you know, be in control of. They got to choose where in their room the plant would go and, you know, how to water it and the kind of plant it was and everything. And then for the second group, they also gave them a plant, but the nursing home staff took care of it and they were the ones in charge of it. And it turns out that this little plant made a really big difference for the people who were controlling it and had the plant to take care of. The ones who were actually taking care of the plant after the study ultimately lived longer, were healthier, were more vital, less depressed. Pretty much most measures of well-being and physical health, they were much higher on than the ones who had the plant but weren't taking care of them. And so what does this suggest? I think it suggests that older people need something, some sort of purpose, something that they feel like they are responsible for and have autonomy over. Then there's a lot of programs out there now that give them an opportunity to give back. For example, there's a program called Encore, which is all about, are you familiar with it?
I mean, I'm familiar with it.
I've been
coached by them before, yeah.
Yeah, so it's all about how you can find purpose in the second half of your life, and that retirement shouldn't be about just retiring and going on vacation, but about giving back everything that you've learned and all your strengths to the world, just in a different kind of way. So I think that, you know, remembering that and remembering that this kind of search for purpose never ends is, and constantly that we have to find it, maybe would help people age more positively.
That and more cats.
And more cats.
Come on. Here we go. Awesome.
Hi, my name is Sharon. I'm from Applied Materials.
I just have
a very simple question. These four pillars, how do you apply these principles and pillars to work?
To
make your work more meaningful?
Yeah. So one of the really exciting things that's been happening over the last decade is that businesses are really starting to take meaning more seriously at work. They want their work to be more meaningful for their employees, and also they want to kind of project an image of meaningfulness for their consumers. And one of the companies that I profiled, which I think does a really good job of this, is the apparel brand Life is Good, which, are you guys familiar with Life is Good? Have you seen their stuff? So Life is Good has this kind of mission, they say, of spreading the power of optimism. And over the years, they have received letters from fans who tell them things like, Your apparel really helped me get through a difficult time. I was suffering from cancer, but I wore your Life is Good shirts, and that kind of lifted my spirits during this difficult time. Or another woman wrote in and said, my husband died in 9/11, but he always wore Life is Good, and that message has really helped me kind of deal with my grief. And Life is Good takes these letters, and they'll occasionally read them to their staff, so the staff can remember that no matter what they do, whether they're loading the trucks or answering the phones as receptionists or designing the t-shirts, that their job is in the service of a larger positive mission. So I think that at work, remembering that you are contributing to something that's bigger, that's hopefully making the world a better place, framing your tasks in terms of that would be helpful. There's a story that that gets told that when John F. Kennedy was visiting NASA in 1962, he saw a janitor in the hallway, and he asked the janitor, "So what do you do here?" And the janitor said, "I'm here to put a man on the moon." And I think that's, I mean, NASA obviously did a really good job of building a culture of meaning because it involved everyone in this big, meaningful mission that even a janitor felt part of.
That's great. Hi, I'm Vid. I wanted to ask about putting some of these ideas into practice. Mm-hmm. I think they're really fascinating, and I'd love to hear more about things that you've heard that help with making the trade-offs around. There's four different pillars. You said we don't have to achieve mm-hmm. in all four pillars. And then how do you balance that against, for example, the zookeeper perhaps may not have earned a whole lot of money. How do you balance that against mm-hmm. all of the other things that you may want to do and mm-hmm. the other activities and the other ambitions that you may have?
Mm-hmm. So I think, obviously, life is about kind of prioritizing the different things that you want. And in the case of the zookeeper, she had just made a decision that that money is not important for her, and that what's more important for her is kind of living out this calling. And there's research suggesting, actually, that people who have a really strong sense of calling towards work actually are more likely to sacrifice pay and to work harder and to even be in positions where they could be taken advantage of at work because they're so dedicated to this that, you know, they're going to do anything to make their purpose come alive. So I think that there's a risk that absolutely needs to be counterbalanced. But I think that, you know, you have to ask yourself what your priorities are. I mean, if your priorities are to kind of be financially secure, then maybe there are other ways that you could realize your calling to help animals than being a zookeeper. One of the things that I like to keep in mind with purpose is that you shouldn't define it so specifically. Like, instead of saying my calling is to be a zookeeper, maybe what's better is to say my calling is to help animals. Or in another domain, instead of saying, you know, my calling is to cure cancer, you could say my calling is to help relieve physical suffering. And then you could find your purpose satisfied in all kinds of different careers and domains. So just being broad and nimble, I think, is one way to maybe get at what you're saying.
I'll also take a shot.
Yeah.
So part of when I sort of thought about my career is moving from always learning something, being challenged, and having an impact. And so my day-to-day, I spend merging and divesting and doing a lot of stuff for Intuit. But I also have, you know, the opportunity to have a full-time person on my staff whose job solely is to make sure we are recruiting, attracting, and retaining our technical women. And so it's always been a passion of mine because I stumbled into computer science many years ago, and it is because of that experience that it's also very meaningful for me mm-hmm. to also make an impact in the lives mm-hmm. of young women. So I didn't choose between either of them. So you finding a way to be a business leader and also being able to do things that are impactful, I think that's a way to put it into practice. So I hope that helps you not make a trade-off. You don't have to choose. You can do both.
Yeah, and that one thing gives you the opportunity to do the other.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey. Hi. Could you speak to the concept of mindfulness and the power of meditation to mm-hmm. purpose?
Sure. So,
and may I also add the importance of being present. Those mm-hmm. are a couple of concepts that are very popular now and
yes.
important.
I absolutely. So I think that mindfulness and meditation can play a few different roles in a meaningful life. I think one natural fit is under the pillar of transcendence. So if you're somebody for whom transcendence is really important, then I think meditating and practicing mindfulness is a way to get there. Especially in our culture where we're constantly encouraged to kind of always be connected and tethered and just get so many dribs and drabs of information where we feel like we can't actually connect with something deeper and something more meaningful. So I think mindfulness is a really great way to get there. With the pillar of purpose, I think that there's also a role for mindfulness to play. And I don't know if any of you guys came to the earlier session on meaning, but one of the takeaways was that to find your purpose, you really have to listen to yourself and understand what you're interested in and what you want out of life. And I think mindfulness is a really good way to do that. I don't know if you have experience with mindfulness, but whenever I try to meditate with mindfulness, what ends up happening is this voice in my head just keeps talking and murmuring on and on and on. And I'm just like, God, this voice has so many things to say. And I'm just listening to it. And it's interesting to hear what it has to say. And I think you get to know yourself a little bit better and to know what's driving your anxieties, what's driving what you're really interested in that you feel like you're not satisfying in your life right now. So I think that on the one hand, it can help us build transcendence. And on the other hand, it can help us get to know ourselves and our true interests a little bit more.
I know many of you probably want to go drink, huh? Is that why we're being so quiet? All right. Well, I know you'll be around. So first of all, thank you for this day. On the board, this is our third conference. I can't tell you how it's amazing to see so many women and men gathered on a day to just celebrate you. So thank you for making the time to invest in yourself. And please, one more round of applause for Emily.
Thank you.
And one final note, Emily will be signing books in the exhibit hall, so go ahead and line up and do that before you get a drink, and check your app for any other sessions that'll be going on, and thank you so much. Take care. All right.